lift your head, weary sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waiting there. You build a mighty fortress, 10,000 burdens high. Love is here to lift you up.
And it's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director, Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're listening live at Joy 620 or via podcast that you can find on our website, investinghope.com. You can also find on iTunes, Podbean, TuneIn app, wherever podcasts are found. So today is one of those days that no matter when you see it on the calendar or on the news, 9/11 just kind of hits you a little bit different. So what I want to do today is look back 17 years ago to the day that really changed many of our lives. It changed families forever. It changed the makeup of this country forever. It changed globalism forever. It changed flying forever. And so I think it's important that we reflect, not necessarily in a sad way, but today what I want to do is give us a chance to look at some stories you may not have heard of what occurred on that day, and some heroes that frankly we need to be aware of that may not be taught in a book at school, may not be discussed on cable news, but certainly something that we and folks that we need to be talking about, because 9/11. Changed a lot of things for a lot of people, but what it also did was for many of us, it was the first time we really had a chance to see, okay, cable news is going to be an outlet for us to watch everything. There's cameras everywhere. So even in 2001, there were cameras pointed at the trade centers. That was before smartphones. It was before iPhones. It was before Twitter and the things in ways that we follow news today. It was before everyone had a camera in their pocket. But it was a moment in time where we not only saw one of the towers burning after the first plane hit, but we were able to watch. And I watched some videos today as the second plane targeted the second tower. And so we saw that in real time. We saw journalists in real time reacting to that. We saw people that were just sitting on their balconies in New York or maybe in their boat in the harbor and filming. We saw their immediate reaction. And we remember speeches, and we remember firemen and police officers and first responders that were running toward the danger and not away from it. And we remember all of these things. And I think for some of us, we look at our current environment in this country, and we see people from both sides, you know, constantly angry at everybody and attacking. And what I remember, I was 17 years old in 2001, and what I remember is I remember everybody coming together, even in my small town. I'm from 60 miles south of Nashville, from a small town called Cornersville. In a small county, Marshall County, and that's where I grew up. And I remember even in my small town, everybody came together. And frankly, if we're honest, we were not fans of New Yorkers in our little small southern town. But we prayed for them. Churches in my little town opened up, and so people flooded our churches. Why? To pray for the folks in New York. And you saw it all over the news. You saw people coming together and chanting USA and the Lee Greenwood coming out and singing God Bless the USA and all of these things happening. We had a sense of patriotism that maybe we haven't seen. I'm pretty confident we haven't seen since 9/11. And I don't know if we'll see again. But we look back to that time and we, for once, maybe we weren't selfish. We were looking to, how do we rally around these first responders? How do we rally around these families? And how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again? And so you see the president and President George W. Bush, who I'll just say it, maybe gave the greatest political speech of my lifetime on the rubble of Ground Zero. And it was an impromptu speech. And as a 17-year-old, I'm watching all of this unfold, and my dad was listening to talk radio all the time. He was a big Rush Limbaugh fan, big G. Gordon Liddy fan, and maybe you know some of those folks, maybe you don't. But my dad was always listening to talk radio, and I used to think, why are you listening to this? Why are you listening to this? Listen to country music, listen to sports. But my dad was constantly listening to it. And then after 9/11, something changed in me. And it made me go, I need to pay attention to what's going on in our world. And it wasn't just watching my dad, but it was also looking at the president at the time. And as a 17-year-old, what I needed was somebody to lead. Somebody to step up and say, America's okay. We're going to get those who did this, and we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. And when George W. Bush stood on the rubble at Ground Zero, and he put his arm around one of the firemen, and he had that megaphone in his hand, and he's talking to all the first responders as they're standing on the rubble with no doubt dead American citizens underneath their feet. And our president looks at all of them and says, this is a moment in history. And some of the folks in the back are yelling and they're saying, we can't hear you. We can't hear you. And President Bush looks at him and says, well, I can hear you. And the crowd roars. And then he says, America hears you. And soon the people that brought these buildings down will hear all of us. And I remember watching that and seeing that moment and going, my life's never going to be the same. And so George W. Bush will always hold a special place in my heart because of that speech, because of the leadership during that time. But I remember as a senior in high school, I was in a geometry class, I think, some type of math class that I've never used since that day. But Coach Lee was the teacher. Coach Lee also was a football coach. And Coach Lee was a member of the armed forces. And periodically, Coach Lee would just walk out of class and not come back. This was a normal occurrence. It didn't concern any of us. Usually he would be gone for 10, 15 minutes and come back. But this particular day, he walked out of class and he never came back to that particular class. So we get out of our first block class and we're in the halls and people are talking. Again, this was before smartphones, before Twitter. People are talking about something going on in New York. But no one's really telling us what happened. So we go to our next class. It was music class for me. And I remember looking at Miss Moffitt. That was our music teacher. And I said, Miss Moffitt, she said, take your seats. I said, Miss Moffitt, we need to know what's going on. And so I grabbed the radio and I picked up the radio and I turned it on. And then we started hearing about New York being under attack, the country being under attack, the plane that goes down in Pennsylvania and, all of the attacks in Washington, D.C. and all of this. And in the meantime, my dad has told me that he called the school. Again, I was 17-year-old, wasn't even living with my folks. I was living with my older brother at the time, and I was 17 years old, had my own vehicle. And my dad called the school, and he, in an aggressive manner, said, are y'all going to let school out? And they acted like it wasn't that big a deal, which did not calm my dad's aggressive tone. And he said, the country's under attack. What are we doing about it? And what are we doing at the schools? And my dad said, I almost came up there and got you. And so throughout that process, what I remember is we left school. I went and got gas. Everybody was in line to get gas because we didn't know that's what you do when something like that happens, because you don't know what's going to happen with the gas cost or even the availability of gas. And then I remember I had a really loud, obnoxious a redneck truck, which I love and miss dearly to this day. But I put an American flag in the back of that, drove that around, and was proud to be an American that day and every day since. And so we look back at those moments, and everybody, you remember the Alan Jackson song, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning? You remember the Toby Keith song that went a little bit more aggressive and talked about putting a boot somewhere up someone's, so as we look through this, we went through a lot of emotions, sadness, fear, anger. And maybe some of those were positive. Maybe some of those were negative, but we didn't know. We didn't know what would happen and what was going to happen next. But if you go back and watch those videos, I was thinking about it today. Their plan, except for what happened in a field in Pennsylvania, the terrorist plan worked out amazingly from their standpoint. They successfully hijacked planes. They successfully flew those planes into the towers and into the Pentagon. And it is believed that the next plane was aimed for the White House, but some amazing people on board that flight had other plans and took that plane down in a rural area. The only thing that the terrorists didn't really think about, they thought they would fracture our country. But the reality is, in doing what they did, they brought unity. A generation rose up. As much as my generation, the millennial generation, seems to get maligned in a lot of different ways, what we have to realize, many people my age, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, during 9/11, marched themselves to a military recruiting station and joined the armed forces and went in to protect this country. And we see the lasting effects of that. We still have people around the globe. We still have people in Afghanistan. We're still losing people in Afghanistan and other places. And so as we reflect today, what I want to do when we come back is look at some heroes of that day. Heroes of that day that should be in a history book. Heroes of that day that woke up just like me and you woke up on 9/11, 2001, thinking it was just another day. But it was the last time they were going to wake up. It was the last time they were going to see their loved ones. But they didn't live out those last hours and minutes for nothing. We'll talk about it when we come back. So as we reflect on 17 years since the tragic events of September 11, 2001, what I want to do today is point us to some folks that didn't live selfishly, but saw themselves in moments of tragedy as folks that could help, that could assist. And there's tons and tons of stories. I would encourage you to go online and search them out and read about the heroic activities of just everyday citizens that saw a need and helped people get out of the towers and save people, even though it cost them their own lives. And whether it be the folks on the plane that went down in Pennsylvania or a businessman, a boss that was working in the Trade Center the day of the attack, and they came over the intercom and said, "Stay at your desk. Everything's going to be fine." And he ignored that order by his superiors, and he saved countless lives by getting people out of the building. And the last anyone saw of him, he was on the 10th floor going up the stairs, not going down, to try to save more people. And he had many opportunities to save himself, but instead he said, "Not until I make sure all of my people are out." He wasn't a fireman. He wasn't a first responder. He wasn't a police officer. He wasn't a military person. He was just a dude that believed that others mattered. And there's countless of those stories. And one of those stories has to do with an amazing young man that was known as the Man in the Red Bandana. And this article was written by Peggy Noonan at the Wall Street Journal. And I just think it's important. I'm going to read the whole thing because I think we need to hear these stories on a day like today. And Peggy starts with, "What do I think about when I think about that day being 9/11? The firemen who climbed the stairway to heaven with 50, 60 pounds of gear, the people who called from windows in the world and said, 'I just want you to know I love you,' The men on the plane who tried to take the cockpit of Flight 93 before it went down in a Pennsylvania field. And they said, let's roll. And I think about Wells Crowther, the man in the red bandana. He was 24 from New York, played lacrosse at Boston College, graduated, and got an internship at Sandler O'Neill, the investment bank. In 2 years, he was a junior associate on the trading desk. He worked in the South Tower of the World Trade Center on the 104th floor. When United Flight 175 hit that tower at 9:03 a.m., it came in at a tilt, ripping through floors 78 through 84. Many of those who never got out were on those floors or the ones above. Wells Crowther had already called his mother, Allison, and left a voicemail, and he said, I want you to know that I'm okay. Only one stairwell was clear. He found it. Most people who would have run for their lives, but he started running for everyone else's. Wells was beloved, bright, joyous, grounded. Family was everything to him. He idolized his father, Jefferson, a banker and volunteer fireman. They went to the firehouse together when Wells was a child. Wells would clean the trucks, getting in close where no one else could fit. One Sunday, when Wells was 7 or 8, his mother dressed him for church in his first suit. His father had a white handkerchief in his breast pocket. Could he have one? Jefferson put one in Wells' front pocket and then took a colored one and put it in Wells' back pocket. One's for show, he said. The other's for blow. Wells kept it with him, a connection to his father, said Allison this week by phone. He carried a red bandana all his life. It was a talisman, but practical, too. It could clean up a mess. When he'd take it from his pocket at Sandler O'Neill, they'd tease him. What are you, a farmer? That is from Tom Rinaldi's lovely book, The Red Bandana, which came out back in 2014. He teased back, with this bandana, I'm going to change the world. As Wells went down the stairwell, he saw what happened on the 78th floor sky lobby. People trying to escape had been waiting for elevators when the plane hit. It was carnage, fire, smoke, bodies everywhere. A woman named Lean Young, a worker for the state tax department, sat on the floor, badly burned and in shock. From out of the murk, she heard a man's voice. I found the stairs. Follow me. There was something she heard in the voice, an authority compelling her to follow. Mr. Rinaldi writes, Miss Young stood and followed. She saw that the man was carrying a woman. 18 floors down, the air began to clear. He gently placed the woman down and told them both to continue walking. Then he turned and went back upstairs to help others. Judy of Aon Corporation had also been in the 78th floor. She too was badly injured, and she too heard the voice. Everyone who can stand now, stand now. If you can help others, do so. He guided her and others to the stairwell. Apparently, Wells kept leading people down from the top floors to the lower ones, where they could make their way out. Then he'd go up to find more. No one knows how many. The fire department credits him with 5 saved lives. He never made it home. His family hoped, grieved, filled out forms. On the Friday after 9/11, Allison stood up from her desk, and suddenly she knew Wells was there, right behind her. She could feel his energy, his force. It was him. She didn't turn. She just said, thank you. She knew he was saying he was okay. After that, she didn't dare hope he'd be found alive, because she knew he wouldn't. They found him 6 months later in the lobby of the South Tower. He made it all the way down. He was found in an area with many firefighters' remains. It had been the FDNY command post. It was where Assistant Fire Chief Donald Burns was found. He and his men had probably helped evacuate thousands. Wells could have left and saved his own life. They all could have, but they stayed instead. He was helping, said Allison. The Crowthers never knew what he'd done until Memorial Day weekend of 2002. The New York Times carried a minute-by-minute report of what happened in the towers after the planes hit. Near the end, it said, a mysterious man appeared at one point, his mouth and nose covered with a red handkerchief. It mentioned Miss Young and Miss Ween. The Crowthers sent them pictures of Wells. That was him, they said. Mrs. Ween had seen his face when he took the bandana from his face, and as the air cleared on the lower floors, Mrs. Young said, he saved my life. As a child, Wells had wanted to be a fireman. Few knew he decided to apply for the New York Fire Department while he was still at Sandler. After his father found his application, the department did something it had done only once in the 141 years since its founding. It made Wells an honorary member. His father sometimes felt guilt, maybe taking him to the fire department so much when he was a kid was why Wells died. Allison said no, that gave him the tools to be the fullest person he was that day. She thinks now of something else. The family spent the Labor Day before 9/11 together at the house in New York. All weekend, said Allison, Wells was subdued, quiet, introspective. Normally, he'd be charging around playing basketball. At one point, he sat with his mother in the living room, and he said, "You know, Mom, I don't know what it is, but I know I'm meant to be part of something really big. I didn't get it. Who would get it? But he definitely sensed something was coming." I asked Allison a hard question, embarrassing for a parent to answer. How do you make a hero? Allison paused. "We tried to instill honesty," she said, "the fearlessness he came with. My husband said he came with that hardware installed. He was this good-hearted little guy, very protective from an early age. Honesty was a big thing with us, and taking responsibility. It wasn't us," she was saying, "it was him. It was Wells. The way I see it, courage comes from love. It makes everything possible. People see the fallen, beat-up world around them and ask, 'What can I do?' Maybe be like Wells. Take your bandana and change the world." 24 years old. Wasn't looking about saving himself. 17 years ago, that family's life changed forever with the loss of their son. But the beautiful reality is that 17 years ago, Mrs. Young and the countless other people that he saved also had their life changed forever. As a guy came out of the ashes and simply said, "Follow me." That's who we are as a people. Those that wouldn't just look out for number one, those that wouldn't just run to safety, but would look and say, "How can I help those in need?" So think about those people tonight as you hold your kids tight. We'll talk more when we come back. I So as we look back at 9/11, 2001, as we reflect, you know, I think on this day, every day, we all go, okay, where was I at? And our stories have probably changed over the years. We remember a little bit more, we remember a little bit less, or we fill in some blanks. But ultimately, what I wanted to do today is look at some folks that that were the unsung heroes. They didn't get the interviews. Why? Because they lost their lives that day. They're not in the history books. But, you know, we at times we attack the internet, but the internet's a beautiful place because it allows these stories to be told. And so whether it's the story of 24-year-old Wells who, you know, unselfishly went and saved lives in one of the towers, or the story of the Coast Guard that you may not know, the work that they put in on September 11, 2001. I think sometimes the Coast Guard gets the back seat. They don't get a lot of credit for the work that they do, and we don't usually hear stories about them. Not a lot of movies are made about their heroic acts. But the U.S. Coast Guard did an amazing thing that back in 2001 that needs to be heard. The U.S. Coast Guard led a water evacuation of more than 500,000 people from Manhattan following the attack on September 11, 2001. They moved more people from the island than the 1940 evacuation of Allied troops from France. according to a new oral history of former commander James Loy. Following the collision of the two planes in the towers, hundreds of thousands were trapped on the southern tip of the island, unable to escape by bridge, Loy said in his recently published oral history with U.S. Naval Institute. As you remember, the footage of the day had this constant stream of people walking north and across the Brooklyn Bridge, Loy said, and not so much understood where the people south of the towers who couldn't go north and east to the Brooklyn Bridge. They went south and into the water. Into the water, frankly, often literally so, but more often in this unending stream of commandeered vessels that the Coast Guard directed to be taking people off Manhattan and taking them over either to New Jersey or Staten Island. A hodgepodge of area vessels were put into service, tugs, ferries, New York police and fireboats, and private vessels as well, to evacuate the southern tip of Manhattan. The Staten Island Ferry, the Governor's Island Ferry, the tour boat that runs around Manhattan became an ad hoc armada that offloaded almost 500,000 people to the water from South Manhattan. The evacuation in numbers was bigger than Dunkirk, referring to the 1940 World War II evacuation of 338,000 British, French, and Belgian soldiers by mostly private vessels from France to the UK. The direction was being provided by young Coast Guard officers from Staten Island that just happened to be on whatever platform they were standing on, kicking hind end, as I will say, and taking names and directing traffic and pulling off this unbelievable debarkation from Manhattan. In the days that followed the initial attack, Loy oversaw securing U.S. ports and restoring infrastructure to low commerce to come into the eastern part of the country. The real reality, after I put out some direction, was in the hands of commanders and captains who were the respective captains of the port and did what they needed to do, including all the stuff I told them to do and whatever else they felt was appropriate. If I'm a Coast Guard commander locally, I don't have to wait for my boss to tell me. I know what I'm supposed to do in the middle of a nightmare that I'm capable of dealing with, and I go do it. During the aftermath of the attack, Loy also directed then-Master Chief of the Coast Guard, Vince Patton, to assign a detail to remove debris from the Trinity Church in New York, final resting place of the founder, U.S. Coast Guard founder Alexander Hamilton. I said, Vince, I need you to get some senior enlisted folks from Captain of the Port of New York's office. I know they're up to you know what, in alligators right now, but we've got to fix that, Loy said. And I was not going to go to sleep before that happened. So, all kinds of craziness was going on that day. You had hundreds, maybe thousands of first responders at Ground Zero, again, running toward the danger as people were running away from it. You had neighbors, you had New Yorkers, you have people from all over the world right there in New York helping carry people out, getting people away from the site. You had air traffic control who was in charge of getting all the planes in the air grounded. Now think about that. The only plane that was supposed to be in the air was Air Force One. So they had to get planes grounded. Our neighbors in Canada at one airstrip allowed for a number of planes to come and land, and they didn't just land there. They set up shelter for those that were on the plane because they knew they weren't prepared for how long they were going to be there. Then you had, on the planes that were hijacked, you had staff of these airlines trying their best to keep people calm. You had 911 operators answering phone calls. You had air traffic controls, again, trying to figure out what was going on. You had the president in the air and all of his staff at the White House and folks in Air Force One trying to figure out where are we going to go? What do we need to do? Who's next? Is the White House next? You had the president arguing and saying, I need to be down on the ground and I need to be with my people, and his staff saying, sir, you cannot be down on the ground. You had the vice president. You have other folks that are putting things in place just in case the worst happens and Air Force One is attacked. You had Condoleezza Rice that was trying to look at it from a defense standpoint. Colin Powell, all of these people working to figure out what to do as the greatest country, the freest country on the planet, was under attack. And then we had the aftermath of what now? The cleanup. Months, month after month of finding more bodies. And then we fast forward 17 years later. And there's anger and there's bitterness. And everybody running to their political corners, and there's tribes that are fighting, and who are we going to, who's telling the truth, and what's fake news and what's real news, and all of these things. And we just think back to just 17 years ago and how different our country was. I saw somebody post today that they posted a picture of the Twin Towers, a picture before 9/11, 2001, and they said, innocence. Man, if we could go back to innocence. Now, I get what they're saying. But we've had wars before. We've had tragedy. We've had attacks. Was it truly innocence before 9/11? In some ways. But it shouldn't take an act of terrorism to bring about unity in our country. But one thing that sticks out to me about all of this is that these stories that I'm reading you, nowhere in there does it say, and they were Christian. Nowhere in there does it say, and they loved Jesus. They were raised in a Baptist church, or they went to Christian school. Nowhere in there does it say they were a Republican or they were a Democrat. Nowhere does it say they were conservative or liberal, white or black, Muslim or otherwise. They were just people who went out of their way to love other people. And so this show, every week, we talk about life issues. We title it "Conversation: A Conversation on Life." Because I do believe deep down, we all have a longing to see life celebrated. Whether it be in the womb or out of the womb. Why were people running up the stairs instead of down the stairs in the towers? Because life was precious. And they wanted to save as many lives as possible. Why did those people on the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, why did they ultimately attack the hijackers? And ultimately take the plane down in a rural area where there weren't any people. Because life is precious. Why did so many people make a phone call to their mama, to their daddy, to their wife, to their husband, saying, I just wanted to tell you I love you? Why? Because life is precious. You see, regardless of what your political bent is, regardless if you label yourself a conservative or a liberal, or somewhere in between, regardless of if you label yourself pro-life or pro-choice, ultimately, deep down, we all are bent toward life is precious. And we should protect it. Now, it gets a little muddy when we talk about life in the womb. But what I want us to know is, ultimately, even those that are far away from the gospel, even those that we would consider secular, they know. They know there's something about life that they just can't understand. There's something about the gift of life that they can't understand. There's something about loving someone, loving another, more than you love yourself. that pushes us to a place where we will run up the stairs toward danger and not away from it. Well, where we will evacuate 500,000 people to safety. Where we would come together as a country and pray for those that lost their lives. Why? Because life is precious and it's a gift. And that's what I take away from 9/11. We'll be back.
Right now, it feels so hard to breathe. Right now, you're asking God, why me? That's what you can see right now. Because right now, there's a greater truth. Right now, there's a bigger view than what you can see right now.
So 17 years, it's hard to believe that it's been that long in where our country's been, what has happened between those during that 17-year period and the presidents that have come and gone and terrorism and all of those things. But if we can't take away, if we don't take away anything else, certainly we should be patriotic. We should be grateful for those that chose that day to say, I'm going to go fight for this country. I'm going to protect this country. I'm going to protect people in it. I'm going to go all over the world and protect the vulnerable. And we have done that as a country. And I'm not ashamed to say that I love this country and that I'm patriotic and I appreciate and support our troops. That we shouldn't be ashamed in that. But in our everyday lives, what are we doing? What are we doing to go out of our way to love the others around us? It shouldn't take a plane flying into a building to bring that out of us. It shouldn't take a hurricane, an atrocity, to bring that out of us. Because we're going to see that over the next few days and weeks. We're going to see people, normal, everyday people, get in boats and go save people, get in trucks and go save people. We're going to see people sacrifice their lives to save their neighbors because of the hurricane that's coming. But what are we doing every day? In a couple weeks, I'm going to be speaking at a chapel for K-6 students at Grace over there in Carnes. And the theme this year is be courageous and be bold. And my focus that isn't just for little kids, it's for us. What does it mean to be courageous and bold? It's easy to be hateful. It's easy to not engage with a neighbor. It's easy to hate someone that believes differently than you. It's easy to not engage with someone that may have different values, that may believe differently than you do. It's easy if you're a Republican to paint all Democrats as terrible people. It's easy if you're a Democrat to paint all Republicans as terrible people. It's easy when we see people as a representation of something we don't like to paint them as terrible. But you know what's hard? And what's bold and what's courageous? It's loving people. Well, they don't deserve it. Well, that's the hard part. But guess what? You don't either. I don't. Did we deserve Jesus to take our cross? Did we deserve that? Did we deserve the empty tomb? No, that's not what we deserved. But that's the example that was set. And so if you find yourself today in the days ahead running to a political corner to make a point, or I saw an article today by a well-known media person, Joe Scarborough, where he was comparing 9/11 to the current administration and saying that the current administration is more dangerous than any terrorist attack. Now, regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, can't we all agree that's a bad combination, a bad comparison? Is that where we are 17 years later? Folks in Washington, that's going to take care of itself. But here's what I tell my children, and here's what I try to tell myself constantly. What actions can I control? I can't control what happens in Washington. Sure, I can vote, but ultimately I can't control it. But what I can control is my reaction and my interaction with people every single day. And so when we reflect back to 17 years ago and we think about the young 24-year-old that went in and saved people, he made intentional decisions that day, knowing that it might be his last day on earth. But he was intentional about it. Why? Because he believed people mattered. And so we can be engaged in all these other processes and all these, the politics and all of that. We need to be engaged in that. But let us be hesitant to label everybody something other than someone that bears the image of our Creator. Every life that was lost 17 years ago, whether they were Christian or not, and this is going to be hard for some people to hear, even the hijackers on the plane, they were image bearers. That doesn't mean all were saved. That doesn't mean all of them had the gospel. It doesn't mean all of them are spending have eternal life. But what we have to come to grips with as gospel people, do we believe the words of our Lord? That man was created by Him. And that we bear the image of a wonderful and glorious Creator. So love better today than you did yesterday. Love better today than you did 17 years ago. Hug your babies tonight. Hug your spouse tonight. Go through those motions because they matter. Because people 17 years ago went through those exact same motions. And the next day, that loved one was gone. So let's not get caught up in the hateful anger that it's easy to get caught up in. Be bold, be courageous, and love somebody. That's who we are to be. We'll be back next week. You know, my heart is divided. And my lips have worshipped many idols. You seem so far, while I need you to be close. And my doubts are at war with what I used to.